Roy Vachon. That was the French say, Vachon. This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
That, friends, was the voice of Brian Brown, creator of the Brown Briefly, some many years ago now. And every week, we try to live up to his high standards of hosting a discussion of current events laced with empathy, intelligence, humor, and, of course, progressive persuasion. Brian's concept of less is more, more or less, always left us wanting more. So let's jump right in this week with friends old and new. First of all, Vachon Airport Commissioner, West Texas devotee, former Army intelligence officer, and high altitude advocate Truman O'Brien, along with his wingman and airplane co-owner, mediator, arbitrator, and vintage European sports car enthusiast, Craig Bellis. Gentlemen, how are you doing?
Good morning.
Doing well, thank you.
Yeah.
Hey, I was just wondering if you might jump in and say, I wonder if you might briefly share any tips on landing a small aircraft into the attic of a storage locker.
Don't.
Yeah, yeah, that was it. Yeah, sorry. I know you had a little blip for me to play there, but I just could not get it this morning. But yeah, we saw that. You know, I cannot figure out what they did.
That Champion has a stall speed of like 20-25 miles an hour. You'd almost be able to
land
stand
on the roof.
On it, you know. That's the problem with going from any speed to zero instantaneously. Not a good idea.
Yeah,
like we always say, it's not how fast you go, it's how fast you stop that causes the problem.
That's right.
All right. Well, good to hear your perspective on that. Hey, we also have historian skipper of the Vashona, president of the Vachon Heritage Museum and guardian of the galaxy, Bruce Hallman, with us today. Hello, Bruce.
Hi, good to be here today. Nice sunny day. Good change from the past week.
Absolutely. And just last night. Hey, we also this week are joined by Small Talk guest Joseph Bogart, who's associated with Save Our Wild Salmon. Good morning, Joseph.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Good to have you here. Hey, mine is the voice of Kevin Jones, Indivisible Vachon, and the Vachon Climate Action Group. And together we conspire to create a livable planet overseen by a government we can all appreciate or at least tolerate. So, hey, let's dive right in and sort of share, in addition to the notion of flying an airplane into the attic of a storage locker, Truman, what else has been going on with you this week?
Well, I am very proud to say and happy to say that yesterday and today I am virtually pain-free. I had another little injection in the back yesterday, and it... Are you... Yes? There we go. Ding, ding, ding. so far, so good. This is the first time in a year that I've been pain-free, and that's pretty exciting.
All right, so cheers for a shot in the back, huh?
Yeah, you bet. Man, I'd do that again in a heartbeat.
All right, Bruce, how's your world in addition to a sunny day without a king tide taking your beach away?
Well, it's been... I leave on Thursday for 2 months teaching in Australia and New Zealand. And Craig, you know what it's like. You've done Fulbrights before, you know, trying to pack everything up, trying to make everything sure everything here is like it is when you get back.
Good luck on that one.
Yeah, right. But it's also very exciting. This will be the first time in 2 years since COVID hit that we've been able to take students to Australia and New Zealand. I've been doing this for 20 years with a 2-year hiatus here because of COVID.
Really
so,
envy you.
That's been occupying a lot of my time right now. But also, and we'll come back, I think, and hopefully have time to talk about it more. But Thursday evening at 7 p.m., Steve Bergman is going to kick off the new Vachon 101 series with his talk on Vachon geology. And it's a series that's going to run into August, once a month, recreating Vachon 101, which was a course Vachon College originated in 2006. So very excited about that.
So that just brings up... Could I ask a quick question? So sure. Do you take students there or you teach
yes,
students?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
You know, I missed that.
Take American students there. We're basically a month in Melbourne, Australia, at Melbourne University, living in dorms. And then we're in Auckland, New Zealand at a Unitec Te Pukenga, one of the polytechnics. Huh. And we live in off campus apartments there. So it's been a great program. So
great. I missed that part. I thought you were teaching students from there. So how cool. That's great.
You would have signed up.
I would have, yeah, you bet. If I had known, I could have gone. Yeah.
Well, I've often thought about doing kind of a Rhodes Scholar version of this program, because there's lots of folks on Vashon who have said exactly that, Truman. So yeah. We could have a Vashon Rhodes Scholar Australia-New Zealand program. Well,
right? For me, I'd be in the Rogue Scholar group.
Well, so, that's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
They don't have quite as many trees to land in.
Well, that's true. That's true, yeah.
Bruce, I'm glad to hear you're addressing the student shortage challenge that Australians and New Zealanders face.
That's right.
Craig, how's your week been?
It's been good. I don't have anything quite as exciting as these two compatriots of ours, but my New Year's resolution is coming along. I had decided I was going to lose 10 pounds, and I only have 15 to go. Boom, 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 yeah. Boom.
All right.
Awesome. Progress.
I think I'm losing ground. And
you have to keep setting that bar higher and higher.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. I was heartened by the Seahawks and everything that came together for them this last weekend. We'll see. The only troublesome thing about all of this is finding a place to watch it. I haven't come across really an easy way of watching them, unless some network picks it up at the last minute. And last but not least, just to do a little plug for all of the other kinds of shows we have on The Voice of Vashon, I had great fun with my co-host on Thursday. We did a show commemorating Sam Phillips' birthday. Sam Phillips is the founder of Sun Records in Memphis and the individual who basically brought on Carl Perkins, Elvis Presley, Roy Orbison, B.B. King, you name it. And we were playing a whole bunch of songs for 3 hours and talking about the history back there. And Mike Nichols, my co-host, coincidentally, is going back for a national blues competition in Memphis in 2 weeks that he and Steve Eiderly, another island musician, won a few months ago, and will be representing the Northwest. So that was fun. That was my week.
Nice. Awesome. Joseph, thanks for joining us today. How's your week been?
Less exciting than the reports so far. I've been back at work. We'll talk a little bit about that in a moment, but I'm still sort of basking in the glow of the holidays. I got to unplug and relax and spend time with friends and family in and outdoors, and it was much needed, and I'm really grateful for that. Grateful for the, developments last fall. Feel like democracy, I'm not sure if we've turned a corner or dodged a bullet. It remains to be seen. But it feels good the way things turned out. I was pretty anxious heading into that. And then I'll just say finally, express my gratitude to all of you for the show and your contributions to Island and community.
All right. Well, thank you for that. And we will have a chance to talk a little bit about democracy, depending on how the time goes today. And I should also say that, you and I have actually crossed paths twice in the last year in the outdoors with ice axes involved in both instances. So,
and without planning, total coincidence.
It's totally out of the blue. So awesome. Let's see. So I'm Kevin Jones again, and I guess the biggest event for me is that the 1.5 year plus remodel of the front porch and the deck is now officially almost totally complete. I have 10 little footings to build for some framing around the bottom of the post rail, the porch rail posts, but otherwise the lighting went in this weekend. household is super stoked that, that we've made the progress. So that means I just have to find another year-long project to keep.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, I think the key words there are almost and just about. These things never end.
Finding another year-long project. I had those lined up, just one after another.
Yes. Well, I do enjoy it, but it is consuming for sure. Well, hey, why don't we dive right into small talk with Save Our Wild Salmon, who is represented here by Joseph Bogart. Orca, of course, needs salmon, and Save Our Wild Salmon is dedicated to restoring wild salmon and steelhead in the rivers, streams, and marine waters of the Pacific Northwest. And so, Joseph, I again appreciate you being here today on Small Talk.
Thanks for this opportunity. Looking forward to the conversation.
Well, you know, first, we definitely want to learn about how you got involved with saving wild salmon and, you know, what motivates you to continue the work.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks for this conversation. So I've been involved with Save Our Wild Salmon since the mid-90s. I've played various roles within the organization and now I'm the executive director. We've been around about, over 30 years. We're a coalition organization that came together in the late 80s, early 90s in recognition that these different constituencies, salmon constituencies, commercial fishermen, recreational fishermen, conservationists, were sort of working at different pieces of salmon recovery, sometimes at odds, sometimes in cooperation, but it wasn't working very well, and the fish populations were still declining. And so the folks, I think visionary people, came together across the Northwest from these different constituencies and formed this diverse coalition to work together, primarily on habitat and hydro issues, big drivers, of course, of salmon declines over the past century. We've been working primarily in the Columbia Basin, which was once the most productive salmon landscape on the planet. And I'll just add quickly that the original salmon constituencies, if you will, of course, for the tribes, the original stewards of the region. And, leadership and stewardship that goes back to time immemorial. They're obviously, as sovereigns, not part of our coalition, but we work in coordination and support the leadership of tribal nations doing this kind of work wherever we can.
Right. Yeah. Super important relationships there that you're involved with. So, you know, as we drive around Vashon Mar Islands, there's quite a bit of lower Snake River Dam removal signs that we see. From your perspective and Save Our Wild Salmon's perspective, what's happening with dam removal? Is this an important step for salmon habitat? And what role does Save Our Wild Salmon play, if any?
So, river restoration generally across the country has been building over in recent decades. I think, you know, several thousand dams have been removed for various reasons. It could be economic, it could be fish and wildlife. And of course, the Northwest, a big driver of river restoration / dam removal is salmon and steelhead recovery. So much has been lost, in large part because of the sort of heavy development and impact and destruction of watersheds and river systems. We're starting to turn a corner and recognize that there's these tremendous opportunities for restoration. So that's an encouraging development and new narrative. And, you know, everyone on this call and listeners are no doubt familiar with the Elwha River restoration, which has been a huge success story and inspired, you know, lots of people on lots of different levels, including on sort of continued momentum to restore. River restoration is this amazing opportunity to sort of fix historic wrongs and go back and make things better. And I think it has a tremendous impact on the ground, on the land, for communities, and then also for our spirits, if you will. I think generally there's a lot of the momentum continuing to grow to restore rivers, particularly those that are aged, becoming more costly, or, you know, because of community values that have changed over time, there's a recognition that the costs of the dams are greater than the benefits they provide, and we're going back and fixing problems. I'll just highlight the sort of major news this fall coming out of the Klamath Basin, where four privately owned dams, Pacific Corps owned dams, are going to be removed over the next, 18 months, under the leadership and push of Klamath Basin tribes, and supporting conservationists and fishing people, other fishing people. So that's super exciting, and it can't happen soon enough given the state those fish populations are in. You asked, of course, about the snake, and the Snake River is probably our greatest salmon restoration opportunity anywhere on the West Coast today, because of the high quality habitat that exists above the Lower Snake River dams, in central Idaho, Northeast Oregon, and in Washington State. And it's been a long campaign underway since the 90s, 25 years roughly, to build the sort of recognition of the issues and sense of opportunity and paths forward, which don't just involve dam removal, but of course, we've got to figure out ways of, acknowledging the roles those dams have played and figure out how we replace the services at the same time. So we're moving forward in a more holistic manner, solving problems as opposed to replacing one problem with another. And so, I'm really excited. Save Our Wild Salmon has been, in the lead with other organizations and supporting tribal leadership for many years on this issue. And it feels like this last year, 2022, 2021, we really turned a corner in terms of a recognition of the problem, the urgency to act, and then the support the political support that we've really not seen before, that has emerged both at the national level with the Biden administration and then with elected leaders, governors, members of Congress from both sides of the aisle. So it's really been the result and consequence of a bunch of good work by of course the tribes, and then a whole lot of citizen activists, many of whom are on Vashon, pushing relentlessly that we're not going to let these fish, these emblematic creatures of the Northwest, go extinct, and we're not going to fail to uphold our nation's responsibilities and promises to tribes. Salmon are at the heart in the Northwest of so many treaty tribes, treaty agreements with the United States. So it's an exciting time. There is still challenges and ahead, and there's certainly still resistance to change. Change is hard, but I feel like there's a lot of opportunity today, not just for progress on this issue, but opportunity for bringing folks together, finding shared solutions, and righting some historic wrongs.
Right. I see Craig or Truman would like to also jump in.
Yeah. I'm going to play the devil's advocate for a moment, because that's sometimes my role. And there are individuals who are not nearly obviously as intimate with these issues as you are and some of the individuals who are on this call. Your website, by the way, is fabulous. It is beautiful, and it's comprehensive, and it's just loaded with great information. wildsalmon.org. Yeah, wildsalmon.org. But I just want to ask the question that or raise the issue that so often comes up with people the moment they hear about taking dams down. Where's the affordable energy going to come from? Don't we pride ourselves on the electricity that comes from those dams, and haven't we done that for, you know, X number of years? Can that energy be replaced without it being out of reach in terms of cost?
The short answer to that last question is yes, but I'll start backwards, a ways first. You know, you said something to the effect of we've had a lot of pride in the region for those dams and the services and the benefits they provided to society since they were built last century. And you're absolutely right. And I think one thing that we've seen is, you know, last century's technology that was really at the heart in some ways of the Northwest culture and our economy, of low cost, affordable energy, which has really fueled this economy for you know, quite a few decades. So, you know, the embrace of this technology and these the resistance to on the part of some to remove them is understandable. And I think that there's been a lot of change in terms of the overall set of public values, appreciation of the costs and benefits. I think that's one of the big changes that's occurred in recent decades and even recent years, is an appreciation that these dams do deliver benefits. They've also inflicted a lot of harm on different communities, human and non-human, and that we ought to be exploring and open to different ways of meeting those needs and providing those services if they exist. And so there's been a lot of work, research to answer the question you just asked, Craig, which is an excellent one. You know, and it's, I think, a sort of bedrock, goal and litmus test for these kinds of transitions. When it came to Elwha Dam removal, there was a larger package above and beyond dam removal that involved making sure that the services, water quality, water supply, and energy production was gonna be able to be delivered without any disruptions and affordably to the communities that had relied on the dams that were now going to be removed. The same is true in the Klamath and in myriad other examples where dams have come down. Of course, you know, there's a corollary here, or an analog, which is we've been taking coal plants out too. We build infrastructure, they have lifetimes, and then they cease to become either they're profitable, their maintenance costs increase, or alternative forms of technology present themselves that provide a different opportunity. And so we do this transition all the time. In the Northwest, because dams have long held a sort of almost mythic role in the psyche of the Northwest, dam removal has been a harder conversation. And of course, it's coupled with this sense that dams are producing carbon-free energy. So, what are we doing taking them out? That conversation is complex, and it's changed a lot over the last 10, 15, 20 years. And it's presented, I think, big opportunities. I want to turn now to the question you asked about, can we replace the dam's energy with alternatives that are reliable and affordable and clean? And the short answer to that question is yes. There's been a lot of research by energy experts, and we have energy experts in spades in the Pacific Northwest that have looked at this question. And so can we remove the Lower Snake River dams, replace their services? Yes. we can do it affordably. I think the opportunities are sort of a mix of technologies like wind and solar in combination with other technologies like demand response and energy efficiency that can help fill that gap make sure we have a reliable energy supply that's also affordable. I will say that Senator Murray and Governor Inslee recently in the last 18 months really dived in to answering that question, along with a couple of other questions that relate to the benefits the dams provide. The dams provide clean energy. They also provide irrigation services and transportation. And they undertook a study about 13, 14 months ago that was completed in this past summer that basically assessed, can we reasonably and affordably replace the services the dams provide? And I think the answer for them needed to be in the affirmative in order for them to think about taking that next step. Dam removal and replacement as part of a larger package. And that's basically where we are today. They undertook a report. It's available online. It's available on our website. They found that we can affordably and reasonably replace all the services that the benefits that the dams provide. And that's what's got to happen first in order to lay the groundwork for dam removal to restore this river and what will be an opportunity or an essential action to avoid extinction. These fish will go extinct. All remaining Snake River salmon are at risk of extinction today, but it also will lay the groundwork for what scientists predict will be the greatest salmon restoration, river restoration project of our generation. Where we can, the habitat that will be opened up is protected. It's high elevation. It's over 5,500 miles of rivers and streams. The potential for recovery is profound, and that's why tribal people and fishing and conservation folks have been working together assiduously over the last 2+ decades to move forward and make progress on this. And so I'll just conclude to say that I think the place we're at as we start 2023, leadership from Governor Inslee, leadership from Senator Murray and others in the Northwest delegation, and leadership from the Biden administration to take those steps that lay the groundwork for replacement of the services, and which is planning and implementing, and then the actual planning around next steps for dam removal when the services have been replaced. And I'll just maybe add one final point, which is we don't have a lot of time. This is a huge opportunity for diversifying our energy system, for investing in sustainability across the region, for creating and supporting a lot of green jobs, and restoring salmon and upholding our promises to tribes as a nation. But we don't have much time, and we got to act quickly.
Sherman.
Yeah, I have three things. The first one is, and you've begun to touch on that, and that is the relationship between your organization and government, and how that works. And I don't know if there's a short answer to that, but that's the first question. I'll go ahead and get all three of them out, I guess.
Sure.
The second question is, I know that these dams are fairly old, and what I'm wondering is there a cost benefit study that looks at the cost of maintaining this aging equipment versus what it takes to replace it? And the third question is, what about the Columbia River? I mean, I know that we have a couple of dams, at least on that. How does that affect the salmon run, which goes on up to the Snake?
I'll take those in turn. As to the question about SOS's relationship with, I think, public officials and policymakers, sure. We're a 501c3. That acts in various arenas around organizing, communications, and policy. We do all we can to engage citizens, to pressure politicians to advocate for policies, and then to support those politicians and policymakers when they're doing the right thing. And so we are very much a non-governmental small d democracy entity that's working to engage people to create better public policies, and of course with a mission of protecting and restoring healthy, self-sustaining and harvestable populations of salmon across the Pacific Northwest for people and ecosystems. You asked the second question about the infrastructure and the sort of cost benefit assessment. And you're absolutely right. I think that there's a number of factors that are taken into account that I think one can think about when these sorts of campaigns and these sorts of decisions. And the economics is a really critical one. It's not the only one, right? There's issues around justice when it comes to dams and salmon and tribes in the Pacific Northwest, for example. There's issues around safety, but the economics is a really important one, and there are some cost benefit analyses the balance shifts, right? As these projects get older, their benefits often shrink, and their costs increase. And that's certainly the case with Lower Snake River dams that were, first started construction in the 60s and were completed by in the mid 70s. And I think a key issue here is the opportunity for replacement services that are affordable that fits within that cost benefit context. It's different today than it was 15 or 20 years ago when we were working on this issue. And that's part of the reason this conversation is opened up and that politicians are leaning in and that momentum is building. There's other factors there as too, including, of course, the impending predictions of extinction from scientists and the loss of the benefit salmon provide in various ways, including as a food source for orca. Truman, I think I'm going to need you to remind me of your third question
about the dams on the Lower Columbia.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. So there are a series of federal dams on the main stem Columbia River, starting down near Portland with Bonneville and heading all the way up into north central Washington State and then Canadian dams beyond that. There are ways of managing these dams and reservoirs to minimize, not eliminate, but to minimize the harmful impacts on salmon. Dams impose, dams and their reservoirs inflict various harms on salmon. They slow the current down. They warm the waters up. They create mortality when the young juvenile fish in particular are moving down towards the ocean. They get lost in the reservoirs. It takes a bunch of energy to swim through a currentless river. There's a mortality associated with the transition from one reservoir through the dam, over the dam to the next, and there's a cumulative impact. And I think back in the 1940s, fish and wildlife biologists opposed the construction of the Lower Snake River dams because they recognized there was at the time a very strong it was our strongest remaining salmon population stronghold, effectively, in the Snake River Basin. And they recognized that adding four more dams on the Lower Snake, in addition to the four Lower Columbia River dams that were already in place, was going to hit a tipping point, and the mortality would lead to extinction and severe population losses. The science reflects the fact that if we remove four dams, that the survival of the fish will double, will shoot up significantly as these young smolts, the young fish, move towards the ocean, typically in the spring and summer months. There will be some mortality on those lower Columbia River, caused by those lower Columbia River reservoirs and dams, but there are some management strategies in order to minimize those and increase survival. All the science reflects that. I mean, I'll give another example. Our strongest Chinook population in the Columbia Basin calls home the Hanford Reach, which is the 51 mile of free-flowing river just above the four lower Columbia River dams. Those fish, in order to complete their life cycle, migrate out as young fish to the Pacific Ocean past those four lower Columbia River dams, and then as adults they come back up. They have to pass fish ladders and swim through reservoirs to get back to that free-flowing stretch of river in the Hanford Reach area. In the past 10 years, we've had returns there in the hundreds of thousands to 1.4 million adult returning fish, and that's after harvest in the ocean and the river. So that's just an example of the you know, there's a balance to be had in management decisions to be made in order to meet both benefit from the dams, but also provide space in the river for the salmon to survive and we hope recover. And that's the sort of system that Snake River fish would encounter. The four lower Columbia River dams, there'd be some mortality, but the expectation is, and all the scientists predict, that it would lead to historic recovery in the Columbia Basin.
Thank you, Joseph, for articulating how many cost elements go into this issue: the replacement of power, the treaty rights that the indigenous people have secured through our government, the aquaculture, the food supplies, and so on. I'd like to move us on, though, to another item on your website, which is about the climate crisis, which is a big issue for islanders. How is Save Our Wild Salmon addressing the climate crisis?
Great question. Of course, salmon and little else has a future if we're not going to aggressively and quickly deal with the climate crisis. It's been created by the production of fossil fuels and greenhouse gases. Save Our Wild Salmon, while we're working to protect and restore and reconnect the habitat salmon need, we're moving forward in a way that also helps contribute to addressing the climate crisis. And part of that is just a commitment and reliance upon energy replacement services that will be, in addition to being affordable and reliable, also need to be clean and carbon free. There's various options there. I think in the Pacific Northwest at this time, the least cost options involve wind, solar, energy efficiency, demand response. It's a combination, a diverse portfolio, if you will, of energy delivery and consumption options for producers and consumers. So we're committed to moving forward in a way that operates or occurs in the context of reducing our overall dependence on fossil fuels. I will add that I am a proud member of the Northwest Energy Coalition board. I've been on the board for 8 years or so. And NWEC is also a member of our coalition. And they are a leading regional organization that's working to tackle exactly these kinds of issues. Assuring a cleaner and more affordable energy system that's also just and protects and restores fish and wildlife in the Columbia Basin. So these are things we, if we do it right and we work together, we move forward in a way that achieves, for example, wild salmon recovery and clean and affordable energy. These are often pitted by those resisting change as either ors. We can either do one or the other. We can't do both. And I don't think, from a mission philosophy viewpoint, that's absolutely wrong. We're pursuing both at the same time. And further, the science, the facts, the economics, the technologies support the fact that we can move forward in this way with clean, affordable, reliable energy supply and healthy fish and wildlife population, including salmon in the Columbia Basin.
All right. Truman, did you have a question?
Yeah, I did. Recently, on the show, we had folks talking about solutionary rail, and they were talking about removal of the dams and the replacement of the barging with rail. And I'm wondering if you're working with those folks as well, or if there's any thought of working with them in solving this issue.
So we have worked with and do work with the Backbone Campaign and Bill Moyer and Amy Morrison. We've done collaborative work for years together around salmon recovery and the related issues, orca recovery and so forth. And in fact, both organizations are helping support a youth-led rally that will be in Olympia this coming Friday in order to advocate for, with youth in the lead, the investments in the Columbia Basin around transportation and clean energy in order to facilitate and lay the groundwork for dam removal, river restoration as quickly as possible. So we have a long history of working together on these issues, and I think we'll be crossing paths plenty in the upcoming legislative session, which is going to be in Olympia, in Washington State legislative session, is also a time of a moment of great opportunity because of the leadership that they're and the policy priorities, but also again great urgency to move these pieces forward as quickly as possible.
Well, you know, I was just going to mention the fact that the legislative session opened just yesterday, and I'm curious if, what Save Our Wild Salmon, what are you looking for as maybe your top one or two outcomes from the 2023 legislative session?
So as I said a few minutes ago, Governor Inslee has really leaned in on being a problem solver when it comes to the issues around salmon and orca across the state and including in the Lower Snake River. We're very grateful for his engagement and leadership with Senator Murray in the last year or so in particular. There's also a lot of leaders in the legislature itself that are committed to making real progress on the urgent timeline required to protect and restore salmon and the habitats they depend upon. We're going to be very focused. We are very focused on this legislative session over the next 105 or so days. There's a couple of budget items that have to do with the planning, setting aside the money in order to begin planning immediately for the service transition. Transportation is one, energy replacement is the other. So those are two budget items that we are working with the governor's office. The governor included these sorts of planning provisions in his budget. And now, of course, we're going to need to work with the legislature to make sure those pieces are included in the final version at the end of session. So those are two areas. There's also an irrigation replacement analysis that needs to be done in order to make sure we have the information we need to keep farmers and irrigation intact and whole and reliable during and then after the transition when the dams have been removed. So it's right now it's about money. That's all about planning these next steps to move forward as quickly as possible around the service replacement.
Fantastic. All right. Yeah, definitely. Oh, Bruce, it looks like you.
I just had a quick question, Joseph, about the sort of the macro and the micro of this. You know, easy to focus on dams and the big dam removals and that kind of stuff. What's going on with the micro end of it? I mean, the culverts, the bridges, the, you know, the road causeways, the things that are like in my neighborhood, Ellis Creek and Ellisport Creek originally had salmon. Now they've got culverts; none can get through. That's all over. There's hundreds of thousands of those all over the Northwest.
I think that's a great question, and I think we're in a moment right now of tremendous opportunity. Generally, we've got the challenges, right? We've talked about climate and these other pressures that are bearing down. Increasing population and development of watersheds and so forth. We also have historic levels of funding available, thanks to leadership by the Biden administration and our congressional delegation. And I think it's important to call out, especially in this instance, Senator Cantwell, who helped secure several billion dollars for funding to address these kinds of issues, not just in Washington State, but across the Northwest. To, for example, live up to our obligations required under a Supreme Court decision to replace culverts and reconnect and protect habitats that salmon depend upon. And so, you know, there was the bipartisan infrastructure law that set billions of dollars aside for this purpose. And then there was the IRA, which presents other opportunities that relate to lower snake and salmon recovery investments writ large in the Northwest. And so there's a lot of money right now that has already begun to be directed to help plan and then implement a bunch of those very kinds of death by a thousand cuts, the culverts and other kinds of things that are essential for restoring the habitat and restoring and reconnecting the habitat so the fish can access it again and we can begin to restore some of the historic productivity that this region once held.
All right, Joseph, so there's a number of ways I think for public, you know, to get engaged with advocating for the type of changes, the legislative advocacy for the budgets that you just described. Tell our listeners how they can make sure to hear about your work and get involved.
Thanks, Kevin, for that question. I want to encourage everyone, if you've got questions or want to get more involved, to visit our website. You can sign up for our newsletters and our action alerts, and you can find contact information for me and my colleagues. This upcoming session, particularly for Vashon residents, and Washington State residents is of tremendous import. And we need all salmon and orca advocates working hard to deliver and demonstrate strong public support for leadership from our policymakers. I will sort of provide a shout out to Representative Joe Fitzgibbon, Senator Joe Wynn, who are both in strong leadership roles in this legislative session, who have both have strong records around, climate, energy, salmon recovery, upholding tribal rights. They're in key positions. They have a great track record. They understand these issues, and they nevertheless are going to need to hear from their constituents that these issues are important. And so I want to encourage, if you're a resident of the 34th, to put a call in, send an email to the senator and representative. That we, of course, have a new representative, Emily Alvarado. I haven't had the opportunity to meet with her yet, but I'm confident that she will also be a really helpful, constructive leader over time in the legislature. So that's one thing that people can do. You have to get information. You have to be contacting your elected officials, and you should certainly reach out to me and others at Save Our Wild Salmon to get more involved and figure out how to deepen impact and help steer public policy. We have a tremendous opportunity right now, and we won't be able to take advantage of it unless the citizenry is engaged and in providing that direction and pressure and support on our policymakers.
All right. Well, I will let people know that, first of all, Representative Fitzgibbon dropped into our Washington Indivisible Network meeting last night just to talk about how that first day of session went. People who are Beachcomber readers who might want to look for that commentary that I had published in the paper about joining a system called Take Action Network, because I will be working closely with leaders like Joseph and others from Vashon who would like to see legislative progress. So if you want to hear those calls to action, go ahead and follow those instructions on how to join Take Action Network. And that's another way that you'll be able to hear some of this information. By the way, the agenda of our climate and environment agenda will be presented at the upcoming Vashon-Morey Community Council on the evening of the 15th at 7 o'clock. So you can go out to the v-mcc.org website to find out when that meeting is or how to join that meeting on Zoom. And you'll hear about these types of goals that Joseph is articulating, plus other environmental leaders on Vashon-Morey Island, that the council, we hope, will approve endorsement of those goals and objectives as the legislative session moves forward.
Kevin, could I add one more thought? I think I just want to quickly return. I really appreciate Craig, Truman, and Bruce, your questions, especially the sort of hard questions, right? How are we going to do this without, you know, in a way that moves everyone forward together? And I just want to underscore that's sort of a foundational piece for our work is bringing people together and finding solutions that solve problems, don't create new ones. And towards that end, the questions around the energy replacement, transportation, and so forth, I just want to encourage people to visit our website. We've got a fact sheets and reports page with a lot of resources, information about that sort of information. And if you're not finding what you think you need, don't hesitate to reach out to me. My email address is joseph at wildsalmon.org, and I always welcome input, questions, and conversation around these issues.
Fantastic. All right, well, why don't we move on? We've been speaking about salmon and water and things like that, and I can tell you Water District 19 right now appears to be ready to remove the moratorium on water shares, so they would be able to issue more water shares here for construction projects on Vashon-Morey Island. And I'd say, who thought that would ever happen? Craig, I expect this might have been a big issue when you were involved with the community council. I'm curious what your thoughts are about this.
Well, back in the Paleolithic age, when I was a president of the community college or community council, excuse me. I have to admit, I'm not totally up to date on what the latest is on that. In those days, you know, most islanders were accused of being relatively anti-development, and they relied on the lack of water shares in order to keep the population fairly level, whether they knew it or not. And the number one priority for islanders when we did surveys back then, big survey, 2,000 people responded, the number one priority was to keep Vashon rural, well, semi-rural, you know, not rural compared with some parts of the country, but to not become Bellevue, Mercer Island, whatever the case may be, and the lack of water shares was one way of really assuring that. The other aspect of all of this is the science. Is there the water? It seems silly to ask that question right now, because we get nothing but water, especially if you live south of here down in California. But in the summer, if anybody can remember, it's almost hard to remember how dry it was. We occasionally will have saltwater incursions and people run out of water. And we are a sole source aquifer. We don't have a river running underneath Vashon. So I don't know. That's an interesting issue. I assume it's based on science to a certain degree and probably to a large degree economics.
It was interesting. The article I read in the Beachcomber talked about they are monitoring the water supply and also recognizing that a lot of appliances now are not only more energy efficient, but they're more water efficient. It's So, you know, there's maybe a combination of things going on. Also, speaking of water, you know, king tides, you mentioned, you know, we're kind of awash right now, right? We had a hailstorm at my house yesterday, maybe the whole island. We had torrential rains. I just couldn't believe how much water came down all of a sudden. And, of course, now king tides soaking Vashon roads and homes. Any comment about how we're going to deal with water? Truman, what are your thoughts?
I just got a call from a friend of mine who lives on the inside the Inner Harbor. And he said that the king tide actually pulled one of his pilings 5 inches out of the ground, which was unbelievable. I just was amazed at that. And also broke part of the floating dock, you know, because it was so high. So I guess I didn't realize that it was that damaging, but I think we had damage all around the island.
Well, we had water. I mean, you looked at those pictures at the mm-hmm. time. There was water up to the restrooms at the Docton Park. There was some of our friends who have waterfront property off of Burma. They have a nice high bulkhead that they've had there for years, just cleaned right over the top and started, taking out the backfill, which of course is going to cause a problem. So I think we're going to be seeing more and more of that, unfortunately. So
as a, you know, the correlation with the warming climate, the higher amount of rain in the atmosphere, water in the atmosphere because of warming atmospheric temperatures, more water comes out. Jump on those climate actions that Joseph mentioned.
Yeah.
To weigh in on the legislature. Hey, Bruce, Vashon 101, tell us a little bit more about what's going on.
Well, Vashon 101 was introduced to the island in 2006 by a reintegrated or reinvigorated Vashon College. And it essentially is a way to look at the island from multiple perspectives. And the Heritage Museum is sort of a beginning, a new version of Vashon 101. It will be online by Zoom talks. They'll be more like TED Talks. But essentially 8 sessions. We'll start with geology and then historic ecology of the island. We'll have Benna McLeod from a member of the Puyallup tribe talking about the fish wars. Bianca Perla is going to talk about modern Vashon ecology. I'll do a short talk on Vashon human history since the encounter. Brandon McLeod, a member of the Puyallup tribe and a cultural historic officer for the tribe, is going to talk about the Shwabapsh people. Alice Larson will do a talk on the demography of Vashon. And Patrick Christie is going to be the moderator and sort of help tie things together. And in August, we'll have a sort of what does it all mean kind of session. So it's very exciting. But you can go to the museum website. It's Vashon 101 is on there. You can register for it. There's no cost to register for it. Suggest a donation. But it's going to be an 8 series talk. So 8 talks in a series looking at Vashon Island. So very exciting.
Fantastic. Well, we'll be looking for that. Mm-hmm. And I would like to look ahead a little bit to our next episode of Small Talk on the Brown Briefly. And this is maybe the Water is Life series, because next week we have guest Blair Engelbrecht from Puget Sound Keeper, who will also be talking to us about keeping Puget Sound waters clean. So for now, for Joseph, Bruce, Truman, and Craig, I'm Kevin Jones. I hope you plan to listen next Tuesday when we get together again for the Brown Briefly. Thanks for being here today. Thanks, everybody. Thank you, Joseph.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.